On Demand, this is the AFR exclusive podcast where we do a deep dive into issues that you care about from guests that you want to hear from. I'm Jenna Ellis, host of Jenna Ellis in the Morning as well, right here on the American Family Radio Network that you can hear every day from 7 to 8 Central Time, 8 to 9 Eastern, and also on demand at AFR.net or also on our streaming platforms, on our AFR app, on Spotify, you know, all kinds of different ways that you can listen. So if this is your first time, welcome. If you are a regular listener, welcome as well. And today we have a really interesting diversion, I think, from the regular topic of pro-life, because obviously pro-life is a conservative, but even deeper than that, a biblical position where we understand that human beings are made in the image of God, have inherent dignity and worth from conception all the way until natural death, and our policies should reflect that truth, and we should be advocating for that truth in the sphere of government, the institution God has ordained, the family government, and also the church government. And so when we mean pro-life, it's not just about babies in the womb. It is also about human beings at every stage of life, including end-of-life issues. So this is really a bigger issue than a lot of what you would hear in the mainstream media. And this article, as I'm just reading through the news that, you know, comes through my feeds and all of this this week, this headline caught my attention because it has so many implications for life issues, for medical ethics issues, and for overall, I think, biblical questions of where does the advancement of technology actually take us, and are we doing a good service by some of these advancements in technology, or maybe we should question them. So the headline is this: an Ohio couple welcomes a baby boy from a nearly 31-year-old frozen embryo. So this was an embryo donated in 1994, and it had been in storage for over 11,000 days, which the doctors who were part of this conception said is now a medical record. And so the quote-unquote oldest baby has been born. And this really has a lot of implications because we know that embryos are humans. I mean, that they are conceived children, whether that is in the womb, it's in a petri dish, and you know, wherever it's located, when sperm fertilizes an egg, at that moment, conception happens, and that is a life. And so we need to talk about this from a number of different angles. So I'm very, very excited to have one of my favorite people on this topic, Father Frank Pavone, who's founder of the Priest for Life, joining me on this topic. And so, Father Frank, were you as, horrified, for lack of a better term, as I was to read this?
Yes, you know, I, and I've been horrified, as I'm sure you have, for, decades in recognizing the moral dead end in which we have placed ourselves by tampering with the origins of human life. I mean, the bottom line, human life is supposed to come about by the loving union of two human beings, because the dignity of the person who's conceived demands that that be the context as to how they come about. A human being is not an object of scientific production or manipulation, and that's why it isn't that the human life conceived, you know, in the petri dish isn't a human life. It is, and that life has all the dignity that you and I have, but that's precisely the reason why that shouldn't be the way in which it comes about. The conception, the fertilization, should be in the context of a loving union of one man, one woman, united in life by marriage. So, having said that, if we start tampering with the way in which human life comes about, we are going to end up in a moral dead end. And by that, I mean you have frozen people. I mean, we use the term embryo, of course, but, you know, you use the term embryo like you use the term infant, toddler, teenager, you know, octogenarian. I mean, you can have labels, and we do have labels for different stages of human development. But the embryo is a person. So we have these frozen people now, hundreds of thousands of them, and the question becomes, what in the world do we do with them? It's wrong to kill a person, and yet they're in these, you know, frozen containers, and what do we do with them? So in this case, I mean, obviously it's clear you can implant this young human being into the natural setting of the womb and bring that child to birth. So literally here we have, what was it, Jenna, 31 years? What was the exact?
Yeah, 31 years.
Time frame here?
Okay. Yeah, since 1994.
So 94. So literally we can say here that this child was born at 31 years old. I mean, that's the literal truth, is that this child is already 31, because the life begins at the point of fertilization. And that's not a matter of religious belief, although, of course, Scripture does testify to that, but that is a matter of scientific fact. There's no dispute in the world of embryology that this is a unique individual of the human species. One might differ about the value or the rights of such a being, but there's no question that the being is one of us. So here we are, and yeah, like you said, it's horrifying to think, because the horrifying thing is the question mark. You know, what do we do going forward from here?
Yeah, exactly. And it raises a lot of ethics questions, as you rightly point out, Father Frank, because this is a person, and freezing a person at any stage of development. I mean, would we say that this is okay when, you know, parents just say, you know what, I'm not really okay with having a 3-year-old toddler right now. Can we just freeze him for a little bit, and then I can go out, get a better job, whatever, and then we can come back and unfreeze him later when I'm ready to have a 3-year-old? I mean, that would be absurd, right? And so why do we presume ethically and morally that it's okay to freeze a child at the embryonic stage? Because you're right, we use these terms like embryo to basically obfuscate the fact that this is a human life that is deserving of its own agency and dignity. And this is why, as well, conservative Christians should be very careful with all of these medical advancements like IVF, for example. There are, I believe, there are morally sound ways to use IVF. And then there are other ways that are not. Like if you are discarding any embryos, those are abortions by definition. Or freezing these embryos, is that a medical advancement that Christians should participate in? I would say no. And so, I mean, there are so many other medical questions that we don't know as well about freezing embryos. So you're right to say that this particular baby boy is born at 31 years old. And so does that mean that he will have the regular stages of life development? Is there a different type of life expectancy for frozen embryos? I mean, all of these questions we don't know. And I think that those raise human integrity questions.
Oh, they certainly do. And, you know, what you were saying also reminded me of, some information I saw recently about the idea of freezing a person in later in life who may have a disease that modern medical science cannot deal with. And so the idea was, let's freeze this person and then wait until, you know, medical science does develop a way of treating this disease, then thaw the person, and perhaps we can give them the life-saving treatment. And what this raises is a very important moral consideration. The fact that we might be able to do something scientifically, first of all, doesn't mean we should do it, and our scientific ability is always going to exceed the moral limits of how we should use it. But then secondly, even if it has a very good effect, even if it has a life-saving effect, it's that old ethical principle, and of course this is a biblical principle too, the end never justifies the means. We may have the very best motives. They might be motives of saving life, healing disease. We may have the very best motives, and we may have the very effective methods, but that still doesn't give rise to the right to do it. And unless we start drawing this line and saying the end does not justify the means, we're going to end up in, this is thrown around too frequently, you know, this term, you know, the Nazi, you know, it is thrown around too frequently. But if you examine carefully what they did in the Nazi program, it was to advance medical science. It was with the very, what Mike Slung might say on paper, our very laudable objectives. We want to increase our ability to treat disease. Yes, but the whole framework has to be the dignity of the human person. Government is in service of the human person. Economies are in service of the human person. Science and medicine are in service of the human person, which means the person can never be manipulated as an object, even for a very good motive of helping other persons.
Yeah, yeah, so well said. And these implications and considerations in terms of medical advancement always need to be filtered through the metric of what does the Bible command for the human being, for our relationship with God, for the definition of family. I mean, a lot of these things that are medical advancements like IVF, for example, have led to a lot of misuse and the ability to, quote unquote, create families that, and I wouldn't even call them families, just like I wouldn't call a homosexual union a marriage. It's not that. But the left and others who are proponents of this would say, well, family can be whatever you want it to be. And they're specifically negating God's definition. So they're creating these quote unquote families from the union, for example, of two men or two women that have no inherent ability in any context, regardless of whether they're the healthiest individuals ever, their reproductive organs, everything's working fine, they have no natural capacity to procreate. And so only with medical advancement are we now commoditizing children. And so this, all of this, I think, is wrapped up into this same conversation and underlying principle that science cannot and should not override biblical definitions and commands.
Yeah, well, let me tell you a story that I know our listeners will find memorable. I knew Dr. Bernard Nathanson, who was the architect of the abortion movement in America. He started out as an agnostic. He ended up as a baptized Catholic. And I worked with him closely. He told the story. He was warning about these things back in the 1980s. And he told the story of when all this in vitro fertilization started to happen. There was a couple who could not conceive naturally. And so what they did was they arranged for in vitro fertilization and surrogacy. So in other words, there was a sperm donor, an egg donor, and then a surrogate mother who, after the fertilization happened in the lab, took the child into her womb and brought the child to birth. So this child, once born and adopted by the original couple who couldn't conceive, had technically eight parents. The sperm donor and his wife, the egg donor and her husband, the surrogate woman and surrogate mother and her husband, and the adopting couple in the end. Eight parents. Well, the adopting couple in the end ended up getting divorced, and the child became a ward of the state. So Dr. Nathanson, decades ago, illustrated this story as an example of the moral and really sociological insanity that results in the destruction of any semblance of family when we start treading into this terrain. Amazing story, isn't it, Jenna?
It really is. And what's sad here, of course, is the children who are the victims of these situations, because this child that we're talking about here, who was frozen for 31 years, did not choose that. The child who had eight parents did not choose that. And certainly children who are commoditized into these homosexual unions did not choose that. And this is where the pro-life movement is so much broader and more and bigger, and I think needs to expressly go beyond just what the common understanding of it is, that it's obviously we are for life instead of the choice or the unfortunate legal choice of abortion right now and making that illegal and unthinkable. This is, yes, about abortion, but it's all about the sanctity of human life at every stage in every decision. Because if parents, and how do we define that term, right? That's a loaded question. If adults, perhaps, rather, are choosing to essentially purchase children and make them into whatever they want it to be because of their own choices, then we are no longer treating the victims of those choices with agency and with that inherent dignity and sanctity that the Bible requires. And so our policy and what we advocate for really does need to reflect the truth of the sanctity of human life at every single stage. And so how do you explain this in all of your ministry and the work that you do, Father Frank, to help people who maybe are interested in the issue of abortion, but they think, well, there's a lot of people already advocating for that, to see that this is so much bigger?
You know, one of the ways I always believe in the power of testimony. So whether it's in regard to abortion, we have our Silent No More campaign, and those that have had abortions testify to it. But even in this matter here of frozen embryos, I know a young woman by the name of Hannah. And Hannah was the first a child successfully, healthily born after having been frozen for a period of years. In her case, it was 2 years. The reason I know Hannah, and people can read about her on my website, is that she actually submitted a brief to the Supreme Court. She is now in her early, well, by now, mid-20s. She submitted a brief to the Supreme Court in the Dobbs decision. Talking about the fact that, yes, indeed, my unique life began when I was fertilized, not when I was started to grow in the womb, not when I was born, but literally when I was fertilized and then frozen. But that was me. All the genetic characteristics that I will have throughout my life were determined in that process of fertilization. And so Hannah is a living example, and she speaks out about this to say, hey, listen, this is a reality that has a face, that has a name. I'm a person. I have feelings. I have a career. I have aspirations. And I think, Jenna, that we know with all... Look, none of us are saying that technology is bad. I want research to continue. You know, none of us is saying that the children conceived in these unusual ways lack dignity. Our argument is just the opposite. They have a soul. They have rights. They have dignity. They have to be protected. But we have to put a face to all of this. Otherwise, we get lost in the concepts, the technology, and perhaps the, you know, economic or other considerations that tempt us and allure us, like the forbidden fruit. Say, you know, it's almost like the temptations of Jesus, right? The devil shows them all the kingdoms of the world and says, look, all this can be yours if you just but worship me. And it's like the whole human family and the whole scientific community are being tempted by the devil and saying, oh, look what can be yours if only you worship me. By doing what? By renouncing your commitment, your absolute commitment to human dignity. The dignity of the human person imposes limits. The same thing could be said about artificial intelligence. Hey, I use it every day. I'm an avid supporter of the existence of AI and the tools that it provides us, but it provides us tools to do good, to proclaim the gospel, and ultimately to bring people together in an acknowledgement of their dignity, not to replace that dignity, not to enslave people, not to harm or manipulate people. And that's always the moral line. I mean, you could look at all these issues, and it's the same story all across the board. The line cannot be crossed between serving the human person and abusing or manipulating the human person.
Yeah, absolutely. And those lines to ensure that we don't have these kinds of artificial manipulation outside the bounds of reality, first and foremost, like all of the gender mutilation surgeries and, you know, and all of these hormone supplements and all of these things that are trying to manipulate the reality of gender. And then also, you know, all of these things that are outside of the bounds of not only reality, but the dignity of the human person, and especially for children and for people who are under the age of consent, that they're not choosing that for themselves. I mean, there still should be, I think, an obligation and a responsibility and duty of the government to protect even adults from objectively harmful choices. There should be, you know, with doctors, first do no harm. And obviously these types of, you know, gender reassignment, quote unquote, surgeries are harmful. There's no metric by which they could say objectively that these are in any way helpful. So those shouldn't be allowed even on adults, but especially not on children who can't decide for themselves and then end up basically with the wounds and the harms of this for life. And, you know, as we said at the beginning of this conversation, Father Pavone, that, you know, we don't know if there's any sort of detriments or life expectancy change or, you know, anything with freezing embryos, especially for 31 years. I mean, that's a huge ethics question that hasn't been answered, that it seems like nobody's considering in all of these headlines when, you know, CNN and all of these other outlets are saying, oh, wow, isn't this cool? And, you know, look, this broke records. But nobody is following up with those ethics questions. And And so, you know, with our policy then, and the advancement of science that is a good thing, generally speaking. I mean, we want science to advance. We have better cures now than we did even, you know, 50, 100 years ago. Those are good things. But how should we draw the bright lines to say, you know, here are the boundaries and the contours of where science and, you know, things like AI and all these can and should advance, and here's where it gets into the evil, actually, and sometimes even the absurd.
Well, we have a beautiful tradition in the ethical structures of thought in various religious denominations, and just purely, you know, if you might say, secular ethical thought that have given us some ways to draw these boundaries. And for example, in the area of reproduction, there's I think the most understandable bright line is you can use scientific interventions to assist natural reproduction, assist, but never replace. So a man and a woman united in marriage come together, they try to conceive a child, they're having difficulty doing so. There are many technical interventions, scientific and medical interventions, that can assist them to conceive. But it's always got to be that man, that woman coming together in a natural union and conceiving within their bodies. So replacement ends up meaning, okay, there's the petri dish in the lab. So that's a pretty a good distinction. And you know, normally you can tell, you know, is this assisting reproduction or is this replacing it? When it comes to the question of freezing these babies, again, the moral line is no. If you conceive in the natural way, that baby is already inside the womb of that mother. That's where the baby belongs in the first 9 months of his or her life. So the lines aren't difficult to draw. They aren't difficult to defend, because ultimately the question is, you know, is this new, individual, unique human life worthy of equal dignity to the rest of us? And we apply the golden rule, do to others as you have them do to you. Sometimes, Jenna, what blinds or obscures the bright line that you're talking about and asking, you know, how do we draw it? What obscures it is this notion that, and the pro-abortion people have used this time and time again, this notion that, well, you know, life is a continuum, you know, from the very first human beings down to us, you know, human life has always been passed along. And they kind of make this observation to try to blur the distinctiveness of when your life began, when my life began. There is a scientifically identifiable starting point, and I find it easiest to think of in terms of each of our genetically determined characteristics, color of our eyes, just as one simple example, our biological gender as another example. When was that determined? It wasn't determined 5 months into our mom's pregnancy. It wasn't determined at birth. It was determined at fertilization, when those specific, you know, genes and chromosomes started to interact and combine into a totally unique, unrepeatable pattern. So there is a scientific beginning of each human life, and that's the point at which the line begins, and we say that being, that living being, must be treated with the same dignity as you and me. And that's where, you know, we have to keep, you know, we have a great ethical tradition. We have to keep delving into it. We have to keep having, you know, there's nothing wrong with ethics committees, you know, get the very best experts from all the different ethical traditions we have, and you're going to find a lot of common ground in those ethical traditions, and we've got to keep applying those, not only applying those to the development of science, but the moral arc needs to stay a few steps ahead of the technological arc, and right now it lags behind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we do need to keep those parameters in place. And, you know, speaking of a lot of these difficult ethics questions, we're seeing a lot in the realm of, you know, of course, with respect to the pro-life and abortion issue. When does life begin? Of course, the left wants to bifurcate that issue and say, well, when does personhood attach, as if that's something separate and actually more meaningful than life, which it isn't. But we ask those questions about the beginning of life. And increasingly, especially with the new HHS department under RFK Jr., the questions surrounding when does life end are also questions that are being raised in the midst of these headlines about harvesting organs from patients who are still living or who may have a chance at survival. And so, you know, some of these questions, and I was talking to someone the other day about this question, because, you know, when we're talking even about organ transplant, like, we know that the whole human being is not just the sum of its parts. And we also know that you know, if you transplant, for example, a part of a liver, I mean, you know, some of those things aren't as serious of ethical questions as some of these other scientific developments. And so when we're pondering this question of how do we know when life ends, is it after the heartbeat? Is it when there's no brain activity? I mean, you know, some of these things of when does the spirit actually leave the body? What does the Bible say about that and the direction that we can apply to some of these ethics questions on in the latter part of life?
Well, of course, the Bible speaks not only of the sanctity of life at the very beginning. We see Psalm 139, for example, but we also see reverence for the elderly, expressed very powerfully in Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, the various books that you have a tremendous affirmation of the dignity of life, even when it is frail and it is weak and it is at its end. Of course, the moral question that you're raising has come about precisely because modern science is capable of keeping us alive far longer than at any time in past human history. And so we have these situations where what would have ended a person's life, you know, decades ago or centuries ago, now, you know, we can overcome one obstacle after another, and if we keep applying these medical interventions, you can end up with a person who is technically alive, but not functioning much at all. Now, that doesn't take away their dignity, but it does raise the question of, first of all, do we always have to keep intervening with medicines and procedures? And no, the answer is no, we don't always have to keep doing that if it's going to leave a person in a precarious situation where the interventions are not really providing a benefit. If there is a reasonable hope of benefit, however, then, you know, we're obliged to take care of our lives and to take care of one another's lives. When does the life actually end? You know, the drawing line that I, in my own training in ethics and moral theology, have always found helpful and understood is the total cessation of brain activity, including the brain stem. And that last phrase is very important because sometimes people identify the end of life with the end of conscious brain activity, cerebral cortex. And it's like, wait a second, that's not the unifying element of that human life. It's the entirety of the brain. You can be not conscious and at the same time very much alive and your body functioning as an integral unit. So we have to talk, when we talk about brain death, it doesn't just mean the person's unconscious. And that's an important distinction that has to be guarded against, because this whole question about organ harvesting comes about. You know, you can't start harvesting the organs of people if they're still alive. And this is a question of very, very delicate lines that have to be recognized and respected.
Yeah, and all of that is such a good perspective, and this is why we need to have the biblical worldview at the foundation of any of these questions of ethics, questions of the sanctity of human life, and also questions around policy. What does our government prohibit? What does it promote? When we're looking at headlines like this of, you know, a 31-year-old frozen embryo that is now born, should our government permit that? Is that the correct agency to not allow this? I mean, all kinds of questions that we don't even have time on this deep dive to get into. But in just wrapping this conversation, Father Frank Pavone, I really appreciate it, because hopefully this at least was deep enough to spark some further questions and considerations for listeners. But in terms of where we go from here, when we're seeing so much commoditization of children, so much disregard for the elderly at end-of-life issues. We're seeing a lot of problems with how hospitals treat or disregard the sanctity of human life. I mean, even things like the single-payer healthcare debate, to say that somehow an individual, if they have less than whatever the standard percentage is of survival of their infliction, then it's not worth expending the resources. I mean, those are all serious ethics questions that we need to pursue. Maybe just wrap this up for us in some guidance from keeping the main thing, which is promoting the truth of the gospel of Christ.
Promoting the truth of the gospel, and this is where Christian healthcare comes in, because we have, and you look at the history of hospitals, for example, with the believers in Jesus Christ who started hospitals. And the whole healthcare system in our country now, you have secular hospitals, of course, and secular healthcare agencies, not that we, you know, despise those, but you have religious entities, too, providing healthcare. The Catholic hospital system, for example, is immense. So, in other words, so much of the healthcare in our country is being provided by Christians, and there are institutions, and we need to defend always the freedom of these institutions, both to train healthcare professionals and to carry out their work consistent with the gospel of Jesus Christ. The good news is that this is happening. You know, we do see a clear division within the medical profession. We have Christian healthcare professionals saying, you know, we have to abide by the kind of, you know, limits that we've been talking about on in this discussion. And then you'll have others who will say the sky's the limit. You know, we're not going to be bound by any old-fashioned moral norms. And we've got to make sure, both by the way we vote, by the way we fund programs in our government, and by the way our policies protect religious freedom, that we can conduct healthcare in a Christian way and teach it to our medical students in a Christian way. And that, Jenna, is very much the answer to this question of what we do moving forward. And it's another arena in which elections have consequences, and we see policies, especially funding policies, we've always got to keep them lined up with the gospel of Christ.
Amen and amen. Well, Father Frank Pavone, thank you so much for joining me on this really important discussion about the sanctity of life issues more broadly. And if, as always, for those of you who have follow-up questions, maybe we'll have another follow-up interview to this, because I know that there's so much more we could talk about. But you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. And I'd encourage you to follow Father Frank Pavone on all the social media platforms, including X at Priest for Life, and also at FR Frank Pavone. And share this episode as well with your friends and family, because this can also spark more discussion around these very important issues that we have to determine from a biblical worldview basis. So I will see you next week here on Demand.